Welcome to the Untangling Web3 podcast. Today we have an incredibly exciting guest joining us on the show, a true legend in both the music and tech worlds. Joining us is none other than Scott Page, the iconic saxophonist and guitarist from Supertramp, Toto, and of course, Pink Floyd. Now, beyond his storied music career, some of you may not know that Scott has become a trailblazer in technology, consistently pushing boundaries with new innovations in digital media, immersive experiences, and now Web3. Today, we'll be getting Scott's unique perspective on how tokens are eating the world and how Web3 is helping to transform the way creative industries work altogether. So without further ado, welcome to the show, Scott.
Ah, thank you very much for having me. I'm actually very excited about this. My buddy Colin told me all about you guys, so I'm thrilled to be here. Thank you.
Awesome. No, the pleasure's all ours, Scott, really, genuinely. I mean, you're associated with lots of my favorite bands. You know, I put Pink Floyd up there as one of my all-time favorites. So yeah, this is a bit of a geeking out moment for me in particular. But first and foremost, Scott, how are you doing today? How are things with you?
I'm doing great on this historic day of humanity. This election is probably one of the most historic days in the history of mankind, actually, if you think about it. Crazy. Because this is like a whole giant shift in how we're going to move forward as a country, as a world. So amazing we're doing this interview today on one of the most craziest, wildest days in the history of mankind. But I'm doing great. Thank you. Yeah, I'm doing very good. Very thankful. Excited about a lot of things in the future. I'm excited to watch Bitcoin is now starting to already pull ahead right now. So I think we're getting ready for a big bull market in the crypto space. So I think things are looking good for 2025. Coming up
here. Nice. Very exciting. Like you say, we're recording this on 5th of November. I think the episode's actually going to come out towards the end of November, but so by then we'll know. I think, you know, whatever happens, crypto is kind of inevitable in a lot of people's minds, and we're going to touch on that later on in the episode and all the many projects that you're working on. But, you know, let's kick it off. We've got you on, and as Jack's already mentioned, we've got to start with Pink Floyd, a real pioneer in both music and technology. Where did your passion for that area really start? Did like their work influence you along the way?
Well, you know, it's very interesting. Let me go back a little further, and then I'll jump onto the Pink Floyd side. You know, my dad was a serial entrepreneur. He's a musician also. I grew up on a television show called The Lawrence Welk Show, which was one of the first variety shows of all time. So he was in that band for 15 years. But during that time, he was a serial entrepreneur. Right. We had boat businesses, lighting businesses, candy business. We owned 26 donut shops at one time. My father was one of the co-inventors of the famous wah-wah pedal, you know, the guitar pedal. Wah-wah. So I've been around music my whole life. And so I always had this entrepreneurial spirit. I've actually launched five companies. Took one of them public, was a NASDAQ company, and been through a lot in the business. I love business. I love the art of business. I love entertainment stuff. So so what was interesting is when, you know, getting that call and playing with Pink Floyd, I was always just totally amazed. I really was following the production process because I was a producer, and I was so fascinated by what it took to put one of these big shows on and take it down. Because I was seeing passes, you know, we were our laminate pass. I was seeing passes like with 150 number on it, right? Like there was just massive amounts. It was like a giant circus moving this thing around with, you know, dozens and dozens of semi trucks moving this whole thing. And so I was always fascinated around the production side of it. So I really took a deep dive from a business point of view, because I actually was launched my business in between tours. Right. So I did that. So I was very much sure. But yeah, they definitely, I'll never forget. We were in Toronto when we first started that, the 87 tour. We were rehearsing in a hangar at the airport, the Toronto airport. And I remember walking up to Gilmore, and he said to me, you know, from a business point, he says, if you make it grand, they will come. And it was grand because I'm seeing flying pigs, flying beds, saucers, 4747s going by the doors. And I just was really blown away. But it was so technologically advanced at the time. You know, there was nothing like it when we could see it. So there was no question. From a production point of view, I got very deep into trying to understand the business models that were around the business and all that. So it had a lot to do with me as far as my technology side, because right after the 87, 89, I had a company called Walt Tucker, which then became Seventh Level, which then where I got really heavily into the CD-ROM world. I saw my future in that. And I was at Comdex. I was demoing a product I did with Jeff Baxter from the Doobie Brothers. If you remember Jeff, the guitar player, it was called Music Bytes. It was a CD that was designed for computer users to use with their PowerPoint presentations, right? So when I had all-star bands, we created this whole thing. And it was like, I saw my future. I was sitting across the room. I looked and I saw this thing on the wall. On a screen, and I walked up to it, and it was the first time I saw somebody click something and it moved on the screen. And I was, that's the future, man, interacting with the screen. And so I dove heavily into that. And then as we kept going with Floyd, I was always talking about, you know, the next adventures, wherever this is going, though I was hanging out in the cyber scene. So yeah, you know, Floyd was really instrumental in a lot of my thinking in so many ways. In my music, Gilmore was the master of melody, and he basically really taught me a lot about playing simple and playing melodies. And I also learned a ton about business, and I learned a ton about production. So yeah, I learned a lot from that.
God, you kind of were the perfect.
Was that a short answer?
It wasn't a short answer, but it was a very interesting answer, and that's all I have to hear.
I kind of did one of those, what is Trump calls the weave. I weaved out here, and then I kind of got back. Sorry.
I think the people that have the best stories, like, they always kind of do that, right? They have so many anecdotes they can pull to any question that you start somewhere and you end up somewhere even better. Yeah. But no, I love it. Don't stop that, Scott. Just go wherever you want to go with it.
Take you down that ramble.
No, but one of the things you talked about was the idea of the CD, and, like, you know, Pink Floyd sold, like, what, 250 million records? I think it's more than that. One of the highest selling artists ever. So obviously they understood the value of fans. And I think you've talked a lot about super fans and true fans and all this kind of stuff. But another thing you're talking about is, like, digital platforms and how they've changed. So, like, how has that changed, you know, the advances of digital platforms changed artists' approaches to building fan bases?
Oh yeah, well, I mean, listen, we now have this little broadcaster in the palm of our hand. It's called a cell phone, right? And now we have a, you know, Twitter or X, we have the 24-hour cocktail party. We can jump on. We can build audience now. Because remember, whoever owns the audience wins in this new game. You can't, you know, I teach a thing called SPACE, which stands for Story, Plan, Army, Conversion, Education, / Execution. It's really a business model. And it really is, takes advantage of the fact that we now have access to data. We have access to the audience. I can now take the order. I can, you know, I don't have to go to some bank. I don't have to do anything. I can take the order. So the whole game has shifted, where we're moving from what I call, you know, the broadcast model, where it was like try to get to millions and millions, and it was all about that, to where now I talk about going small. It's all about taking and building that hive. I always say this, if you want to survive, you got to build a hive. And that's around a small group of people that really care about you, what you're doing. And that's why I love Web3 and I love NFTs so much. Because it changes the game for the artist. Because you can't sell music anymore, right? Where do I sell music? I can't sell. Nobody buys a disc. That's gone. Somebody gave me a CD the other night. I said, well, where am I going to play this? I have no idea what I'm going to do with it. And then downloads, you don't download anymore. It's all streaming services, which was a horrible business model for artists today. Because it's like, it's good for maybe 2% of the entire market. Because, you know, it's roughly around $1 million. I mean, a million streams will generate roughly around $4,000 in revenue, depending.
Yeah.
But the only problem is there's only like 2-3% of the entire Spotify catalog that reaches a million streams, right? So it's really a bad business model. So the whole game has shifted now, and why Web3, I'm so excited about what happens with Web3, is because we now have this crazy little thing called an NFT, a non-fungible token. And the power of that to build business models on and to create wealth and to create tradable and gives. Because if you think about an NFT, it's a programmable contract, right? It's a contract you can attach to anything that allows you to create value to it. You can create scarcity. It can be a digital asset. I mean, if you think of NFTs, they're great for access control. They're incredible storytelling devices. They're incredible ways to collaborate and build on top of it. I can hand you an NFT and I can give you the rights to build on top of it, and we can both share in revenue. So the whole game has shifted now around from the old school of record business now to this direct-to-consumer, fan-to-fan, fan-to-band, fed to ecosystem where we can build circular economies now around an artist. This is the greatest time in history for the independent artist. From my point of view, we've never had the tool sets and the ability to run and control our own destiny. And let me just give this little story, because I do this at every freaking one of these things. I always say this. So anybody that's seen my interviews, you'll always hear this. I went to an NFT meetup about 3 years ago, and this girl gets up. She says, I'm 19 years old. I'm a photographer. I love photography. I'm going to be the greatest photographer in the world. I get up every day and shoot pictures all day long. She says, I got into NFTs 9 months ago, and I'm so excited. She says, because I pay all my rent and I pay my car payment. I live 100% off my NFTs now. Uh-huh. And she says, this is what got me. She says, and I carved a small portion of the smart contract off for my local community center, and they've already received 2.5 ETH. Which was the equivalent of $10,000. So that's why I talk about the new models. This is the people's movement. How many 19-year-old kids, young artists that nobody knows really out in the public can actually create a business and live off of what they love to do? This is a fundamental shift in the way we're going to do business. I think tokens are about to eat the world once people start to grasp the power of them. So this has really changed the game. We're moving from this broad to where you want the funnels to lead them into your own tribe, your hive, and you build from there. So I'm very excited about this, because I've already seen so many success stories. A couple that are doing great like this, for people that aren't really that famous as far as thing. They built their own hive, found the people that care about them. That's the game right now.
So we often hear this from the actual techies, the ones developing it, and they'll just talk about the technology for 3 hours and most people are lost. But you're kind of both. You're a creator and a technologist, so you kind of understand the value from both perspectives. What is it then? So the difference between, say, what we have now, I know we've been in the creator economy for a while now, but is the main difference you see from having these NFTs now that we don't have these intermediaries in the middle, the Spotify's that take a big margin? What is the real core value proposition for an NFT from a creator perspective?
Well, first of all, we're moving from the creator economy to the relationship economy. That's where the whole thing based on relationships now. You see it. That's what's so beautiful about tokens. I love the concept of traditional kind of meme tokens. Those are great for building audience. And then you take NFTs, and that allows you to create the circular economy, create value, give people a reason to be involved. They can invest in their entertainment now, and they have secondary markets that they can sell and buy and trade in. So it's a big change in the way business is being done, because now I can create something that has scarcity, that is unique, that has a secondary market to it, because I can buy it at this price. And again, it's all about story. If the story behind that asset is powerful, it'll change the value of it. So now I can own it. Before I could get a, if I got behind a photographer, I could own their collection, but where would I sell it? What could I do with it? How could I make any value out of it? So it creates the opportunity for the ownership to completely change and having secondary markets. That's like a big, big deal, because now I can invest in my entertainment and actually have a way to go sell it. I can trade it, I can sell it, I can rent it. So there's all these new business models that artists can build on top of these NFTs that completely changes the game. And what's great is it doesn't take that many to sell a lot, right? And if you got a hive of people that love it, that collect your stuff, and you keep building the story and the strategy around it, it's just, imagine if you were able to buy the NFTs for the early days of, let's say, U2 in the club, when you bought them for $50 or $100, then U2 is now massive. I got to invest. Yeah. Those NFTs from those early days could be worth thousands and thousands of dollars.
I get that. That's a huge point. There's something very kind of intuitively human that's about collecting and ownership, and also the community aspect as well. It's the social flex. If you say you had that U2 collectible, one of the early ones, you wouldn't sell it immediately. Most people would be like, I'm going to hold on to that. It shows I'm the biggest U2 fan ever. It's a bit of social currency for me to say, look how much of a fanboy I am. I've got this stuff. So I get what you mean. It's really taking the pure media aspect and really tapping into something that's quite core to being human, the ownership community feel, and it's kind of a perfect combination, right?
Yeah, well, collectibles are a $400 billion a year business, memorabilia, all that stuff, right? It's a huge business. People like to collect, and they collect, a lot of them collect it because they're building collections that have value over time. right? You know, there's people that collect every ticket from every stub. So now I've got the ticket from the Rolling Stones. I see it out there. They're selling it. I'll sell this ticket. So there's a value exchange now. People can invest in their entertainment. It's like I have a project right now called My Moon EXP, where I have a thing called the Golden Mullet. Anybody wants to check out the Golden Mullet, you can go to mymoonexp.com and see this thing. And it's basically all the stuff I put on the moon. And it's actually the Golden Mullet is made up of all my Pink Floyd photos that nobody's ever seen before. Right. But what's interesting about it is I built a circular economy around it, because I take that mullet, I break it up into 50 pieces at different events. I did it at Bitcoin 2024 and I have people paint on top of it. Then I create NFTs out of their artwork. Now we're partners. And I create 10 more, and then I create a new mullet called the Nashville mullet based on it. So now everybody, we're collaborating, and now you just paid, you know, $500 to paint on this thing, right? And then what happens is you've just invested, you get 10 NFTs that you collaborated with me, and now we're business partners. So now what I'm building is an entire army of people that I'm collecting a chunk of. We're building together. They're happy because they get to be part of the moon project and have something cool they can hang on, that put on their wall. But also they just invested. Those things should be worth $500 a piece. They could, that $500 they spent would turn into $2,500, right?
Is this part of the kind of the programmability of the NFT itself, that if you're an early contributor, then you get royalties from contributors further down the line? Is that part of the kind of the token protocol?
Well, yeah, because you can build into the smart contract with how the splits are, right? In the smart contract, you put the splits and that's where it is. So when you invest in your piece of art that you're going to make, it's cool. You get to put it on your wall. It's one of a kind. It's only 50 of them. It's got all this scarcity. And yet at the same time, we created a collection that now we're going out to sell. You got 50% of the revenue. So you make, you spend 500 and you make 25 or something or more. Who knows? And it could be 5,000, whatever the price is, right?
Yeah. And I think this is touching on something quite fundamental. And, you know, there's a reason why I think NFTs are or were the gateway to many people to this whole Web3 world, right? To this, as you put it, the relationship economy, which I think is a really nice way of putting it. But NFTs were the first thing, I think, that really captured the mind of the kind of general public about this technology and all those properties that you mentioned, right? The scarcity, the programmability, the ability to share royalties, all these things really seem to resonate with people. And, you know, this relationship economy, I think, is something that was maybe just starting to see, you know, green shoots of in the Web2 world. You have the Patreon type things happening, but they're still based in these walled gardens. They don't have the secondary markets like you mentioned. So, I think that's right. The feels to me like the key of it is that this new technology was enabling something that people were after, right? We've had these years of the algorithms and the social media platforms kind of locking us in. Now we kind of, you know, have a finally a technological means to address them. And that's kind of how we use NFTs now, right?
I think the tokens are about to eat the world, because the power of them, once people realize the power, it's freedom for the people. This is freedom, man. This is direct to consumer, wallet to wallet, transactions, you know, quick, this thing. This is it. And, you know, now you got BlackRock, which is not the biggest fan of, but they just said they're going to basically put, you know, they're looking at $1 trillion invested in tokenization. I mean, they see this as a big play. And then you also saw what MasterCard, Visa, one of them just did, they're dropping their NFT program. So I think what's happening is going to get into the mainstream now, because remember, ownership changes. I could be driving down the street, there's a QR code on a building. I could buy a fraction of that building, like right there on my phone. That's a big deal, right? When you can basically shift ownership that quickly to somebody, track it and make sure that it's authentic and all that. I mean, this is crazy. Your tokens are about to take every business. I don't care if you're in the hair salon business, you own a record store, you've got a gym, every tokens will be part of everything, because it allows for that, like I said, access control and experiences and loyalties and points and all these things that we can now incentivize with the people. It's just like right now we're tokenizing our wing. We have a food franchise out of Australia called Shiba Wings. And Shiba Wings is the first crypto restaurant in Australia. We've got it to number one now on DoorDash, Google Eats. It's number one in Keble Avenue and sort of the best place. We're now just dropped the token on that. We're tokenizing that whole thing, and we're building a circular economy around a food business. So we're launching franchises where we're building businesses, creating for giving entrepreneurs easy ways to start a business, and we're creating jobs, and we're also building the community. We built this model where the token, the restaurants each buy the token, they contribute every month to a marketing kind of fund that goes in, buys our token, right? And then we take that 5% back and we use it to build the community. Right. So it becomes this circular thing. So every time somebody buys some wings, ka-ching, we're feeding the chart, which allows us to have the marketing materials, and we feed it all back into the community. Because this is community-owned businesses, is the power of what's going on. That's why when you look at Bored Apes, why is it so big? It's not, people would say, why is this JPEG worth $1 million I've ever back in the day? It's not the JPEG, it's the rights, rules, permissions, and ownership of that brand. It's a distributed brand. We're doing the same with Shiba Wings. And the other part is we own the Shiba Inu logo, which nobody, people know. That's just coming out right now.
Didn't know
we
that.
Actually own the trademark, own that. That's one of the third most powerful logos in crypto. It's the most third recognized. So we can see that this whole world is starting to shift where we can take a real world business to feed the token economy and the economy back and forth. It's an incredible time right now, man. There's all these new models that are coming out that are just fantastic.
I'm just looking at Shiba Wings right now, and it's kind of the idea of a restaurant, which it looks great, by the way. The idea of a restaurant having a PDF with a section on tokenomics is a bit mind-boggling. Like, it really is so far flung into the future. Like, this restaurant have its own crypto address. I love this. Like you said, this is really power to the people. And even restaurants, like, so much of them is about community and people buying into the brand. So this kind of stuff makes so much sense to have transparency, you know, community governments, because it gets people to believe in the system and participate in it, right?
Yeah, so absolutely. And what's great is our business model is really around powering the franchisee, the guy that buys the ghost kitchen or does the mobile truck or location, and we're building the community building infrastructure for him around Web3 to build his business, because we have new business models now that where they can make more money off of the collectibles, the experience, the, remember, I can have what I'll call future vintage clothing, where I have a shirt that was made for a special event we had at our food truck, where we had a live concert that we streamed with, you know, the Chili Peppers or something. And now that becomes a collectible that can be changed on, and it's all around the food watering hole, right? So we're using food as the piece. We've got an incredible, I mean, listen, the food is awesome from this truck. People are driving everywhere to it. So it only makes sense that we bring it out. And our, again, if you look at Shiba Wings, even though we're selling, you talk about our food franchise, we're really a media entertainment technology and community building company. That's what we do. So, because we can build culture around every one of our franchises now, and give them the tool set to create that loyalty program and rewards and experience and ownership that hasn't been done yet. And we finally are at that point because the technology is finally catching up. We can get somebody on, like we have an app called WingSwap with our partner Pay It Now. Pay It Now was our original currency. Our, you know, you could buy with crypto in our store and buy food, buy burgers, all that. You could swap between tokens. Well, WingSwap is our partner. So we're, I mean, Pay It Now is our partner. WingSwap is our app. And that app, if you think about it, really becomes like Uber. Uber, when you wake up to go to Uber as an Uber driver, you turn on your app, you say, hello, good morning, app. How are you today? Same with us. The app will drive and run the franchise for these people. It'll have a piece that's running the back end for the food franchise. And the other part is the experience layer for the franchisees, for their customers. Right. So this is really about building culture around each individual franchise, giving them the tool sets to make it happen. And Web3 is an incredible opportunity for them.
Well, I think that's a really nice kind of way to put that, because I think, you know, a lot of people who may have clicked on this episode, right, for you, Scott, and they're now hearing all these weird and wonderful things that you can do with Web3. And they're thinking, okay, how do we marry these up? But I think you really touched on, I think, the important idea there is almost the use of Web3 as this infrastructure, because a lot of people will take a look at crypto and this kind of industry in general, right? And they'll say, this is a lot of rubbish. There's all these meme tokens, like you said, and they're just useless. But actually, what you've just described is the infrastructure side. This is the building businesses side. This is, you know, providing genuine value, improving loyalty for franchises and brands. I think that's the key message, right? And I think that's something that will actually resonate with people a lot more, especially, you know, music is one of those places where people have the most loyalty. People will fight to the death over, you know, arguments over which is their favorite band, favorite artist. Yeah. I'm curious to kind of plug a gap, though, in my head, because, you know, we talked about you, Scott, as your early career, your interest in entrepreneurship as alongside music. And then now we're deep into Shipper Wings and all this stuff. Where did your interest in Web3 actually start? Like, what was the point in time where you transitioned from just thinking about, you know, your entrepreneurial endeavors and music? I want to know, was there something about the industries you were in where you saw an opportunity, or was it kind of just was it something that was kind of innately interesting to you about it?
Well, I've been a technologist. Again, all my companies have had are technology companies, right? So Seventh Level, we basically developed. I co-produced and directed with our CTO and stuff, the world's first interactive cartoon called Toonland. Mm-hmm. So I've been around technology a long time. That was, we were running on a 386, 25 megahertz Windows machine with 4 mega RAM. Think of that, powerful 4 mega RAM. And we're making animations and cartoons and stuff happening on the screen. So I've been around technology for a long time. So I'm constantly in it. I started a multimedia messaging company. So we built a whole infrastructure called Mashcast with my company New Media Broadcasting. So I've been around technology's been it. So I've been watching the wave. And what happened was I got sort of started getting into seeing where crypto or getting introduced to crypto in about 2011. So I was there early in the days around that. And I was following things and obviously following CryptoKitties when that all came out, because that's what we do as technologists. You got to stay on it, because 90 days, you know, the game changes. So you got to be on top. So I'm a technologist. And I got a call from a guy saying to me, I was getting a bunch of calls when NFTs, you remember when Beeple had the big, that was the big turning point, you know, the big Beeple $60 million NFT project, right? And that just got everybody's attention. Everybody was hitting me up at that time saying they knew I had a massive collection of all my Pink Floyd stuff and my Supertramp and Toto. I mean, all this stuff I've collected through the years because I've been a collector. And they said, you got to NFT this stuff. And I'm like, well, what is it? And I started meeting with people that wanted to do it. And I thought, man, these deals don't make sense. I'm going to go build it myself. I have my tech company guys, my buddies. I called my blockchain bros. I said, dude, let's go after this. And then we went out and we got lucky with Ruby Mazur, who is the guy that did the Rolling Stones Lips, was doing an art show. Wow. Talked him into, hey, dude, you need to NFT these things. Said, okay. We ended up, went to Hawaii. We sold our first NFT for $1.1 million. That got my attention. I said, because I can remember I was really trying. At first I was like, I still don't get this, right? It was just too hard to wrap my head around why a picture that I could duplicate or copy anybody would even care about, right? And then I remember it was like, well, when all this stuff was going down, I remember sitting, all of a sudden I sat up in my bed. I was laying in bed. It was about 2 a.m. I was going to sleep and I was just obviously brainstorming, thinking. And then it just hit me what the power of an NFT was. And I stood up my bed and I went, holy shit, this is the biggest thing to come along in a long time. Because I believe the NFTs and the tokens is going to drive mass adoption for crypto. Because it's like people could get into collecting their favorite, you know, piece of media or their favorite clip. I mean, look at what you see with, you know, the sports stuff that's going on the Flow Network. I forget what it was. You know, they're selling basketball shots and, you know, all this stuff where people want to own this stuff, right? They want to have it in their collections. They want to flex. It's like, great. And what's nice about the digital stuff is if I've got a collection of digital, I can flex with my cell phone. I can say, dude, check me out. I got one of five of these, right? So there's a whole, you know, an interesting experience level. I think NFTs represent experiences. That's what they do. They allow you to build an experience, which is what it's all about, right? People will pay for an experience. And and like I said, anything can be valuable. I could take this cover to my cell phone and I could make this an NFT. And they would say, well, who care about that? But if the story was, oh, this NFT belonged to Mick Jagger, then it went to, you know, it was Mick Jagger and Frank Sinatra, and they wrote My Way with this on their cell phone. I mean, whatever it is, if the story is there, then the value proposition is there. So everything about NFTs and all this stuff is about building the story, and storytelling is the game, all of it, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's got a bit of a flashback there, Scott, from like the Wolf of Wall Street scene where it's like, send me this pen. And you were just selling us the phone case and he sold it straight away. Like,
updated for 2024.
Right? Yeah.
Yeah. It's such an interesting way of putting it, though, Scott, I think. Because I've actually seen, you know, one example you've made me think of is I've seen jewelry companies now which look into the sourcing of their jewelry to find stories, to find previous owners, to find the history, the life, who it's been passed down through. And I think that is exactly the concept that can imbue so much meaning, is that storytelling side to NFTs. And beyond that, I think that's a really important thing you've hit on there. Because again, we're simple creatures. We love good stories, right? I'm a sucker for a good story. I love films, right? So that I completely understand where you're coming from.
Yeah. What about the story of a dollar bill and a $100 bill? They're both exactly the same except for the number.
Yeah, well, that's you're getting into a whole other
kind of
thing.
Right, I mean, just think about it. That's the
value.
Point.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
The story is that this is worth 100 and this is this. And the dollar is not pegged to anything. It's not tied to gold or anything anymore, right? So
yeah,
the same thing. It's all about belief and story and what will people buy into, right? And
sure,
100%.
I think that's a really nice segue, Scott, because I wanted to ask you about something. I saw you, you know, speaking in another podcast about this idea of free thinking, right? Which I think relates to storytelling about information and how we receive information online. And I think for me, we've talked a lot, you know, Alec and I on other episodes of the podcast about the way in which we interact with social media right now, the problems with the big platforms and players. But what's your take on that? Because for me, you were kind of getting at some of the same ideas of free thinking. So yeah, if you wouldn't mind just kind of guiding us through what is that concept?
One of my favorite subjects, actually.
Okay, great.
Because it ties to consciousness, right? To free thinking and consciousness kind of go together. Consciousness is my favorite subject, and free thinking is something that has been overthrown through the algorithms. Remember, whoever owns the algorithms controls the people. It's very simple, because we now know human behavior, behavioral science. We've got all this knowledge now through behavioral science on how to make things work. There's a couple things. I mean, if you want to really understand what's going on, there's a book called Hooked, How to Create Habit-Forming Products. All right? Mm-hmm. And it's basically a loop of four things that go over it, over it, over again. And once you get a thing, people get hooked, right? They get involved in it. There's a trigger, there's a reward, there's a thing. It just goes through this process. Well, they've now figured this out. This is marketing, right? It's all about behavioral science. I mean, once people realize that people do not buy products, behaviors buy products. Right. So once you understand people's behaviors, you can move things. So now it goes to free thinking. It's amazing to me right now. You can see how powerful these algorithms have been, because you can see this craziness amongst the people not being able to talk to each other and not being friends anymore. And you're kind of like, what happened? Everybody was good before. We could have, you know, the left could talk to the right could talk to the left. We could have a beer and everything was good. And now, you know, I've seen people like, it's mind-boggling to me, again, about free thinking, is that somebody that was a good friend will say something like, if you vote for Trump, or you stay out of my life. It's like, why is that all of a sudden, somebody that's a good friend? Well, this goes back to the concept of free thinking, is being able to stay at above and not worry about information. They've got everybody so twisted by what they want their agenda, that people are buying into it. They're in their echo chambers, right? They get the same things over and over again, where people cannot even free think anymore. And what I mean by that is, you can put a fact, somebody can actually look at something, see it, taste it, feel it, they won't believe it, right? We've gotten to that point, which is fascinating. So the concept of free thinking is really stepping up. It is, in my mind, it's a form of consciousness, because then what happens is, which is my favorite stuff, we could go down this rabbit hole. I don't know if you want to go down this one, but real quick, try to explain to everybody. The only thing that's real is we're talking right now. Everything else in your life, it's an illusion. Everything. 5 minutes ago, I can't touch, I can't change, I can't move. I can have nothing I can do with it. I can only remember it as a thought. 5 minutes from now, complete illusion. I don't know what's going to happen. I can't change that. I can't fix that. The only thing is this, right? Well, what happens is when you're programmed like this and you identify with thinking, that's what happens is you think the thinker is the person. When truth, it's really watching thoughts, becoming the watcher of the thinker, is where that consciousness, and that's where free thinking happens. It's getting you not be like, somebody says, don't watch that news station because it's all lies. And you're, I'm going, it's just information. It's information. Yeah. I want to know everybody's information, even if they're lies. I want to know, because how am I going to know? But by comparing and free thinking and looking at all the data and getting a feeling of what's going on, especially at a time like this, where free thinking is completely thrown out the window. They can't free think anymore. It's crazy. So it is, I think we're, this is, you know, the great awakening, in the sense people are now waking up in groves to what is actually going on here.
Talking about consciousness is something me and Jack have spoken about in depth. And obviously, you know, tying that with social media, the conversation then takes the turn towards artificial intelligence. And what is artificial intelligence? And I think there's been a lot of kind of saying, negative press around, you know, social media and why the algorithms do what they do. And there's been a whole debacle around freedom of speech. And, you know, I will say now, I believe in absolute freedom of speech. But one of the problems with social media is not freedom of speech. It's what is prioritized by the algorithms, right? If I am Twitter, Facebook, whatever it is, and I say, you know, this algorithm's entire job, this AI model's entire job is to boost engagement, and then I'm testing on millions and millions of guinea pigs constantly, it realizes that some of the receptors that mean maximum engagement are, you know, hate, greed, these kind of like emotions we'd express as negative, then I start to create these echo chambers of what people like. And I think, like you say, we really need to get a step back from what we see online and operate in a more free thinking mindset, where we say, this is just data. Let me process it from a different perspective and see, you know, be more empathetic potentially.
Yeah. I mean, the algorithms got us to what I call hate in the name of love. And what it is it's like, I see so many people, I'm so loving. You go on their Facebook page, you know, they're namaste, you know, be kind, be everything. And then all of a sudden, like, let's say either a Trump or a Harris, they go, come on. And it's like, right? And it's like this hate in the name of love. I'm so loving, it's okay for me to hate. And hate is just hate. It's just in general, it's the same thing. But yes, the algorithms feeding us. And I was telling you, I've got a project, an NFT project called Synthtopia, synthtopia.world. And this whole thing, it's all AI. We designed it this way, where AI creates everything. We do the whole thing. And the reason is, the story is, in order to get out of the matrix, you got to be in the matrix, right? It's all about free thinking. How do we get out of this model? So we're using all these tool sets to basically do it. Because listen, AI right now, people have no idea, truly, most people have no idea what's basically coming, right? I mean, this is, humans are designing themselves out all day long. I mean, if people haven't even seen Payman, have you gone to Payman? Do you know what Payman is?
No.
Okay, so Payman is an AI run website that uses humans. It pays the humans to solve the problems it can't.
Oh, really?
So the AI is hiring the humans to answer the questions that they can answer.
We're enslaved already.
So the humans are just feeding the information in. So they're just sucking everything out of humanity, right? And getting to the point where it was this. Yesterday, I was doing a Twitter space, and one of the people that were on the thing was a robot. Talking the whole time, answering the questions, doing all this stuff. Sounded like a human.
It wasn't a politician?
No, wasn't a politician. It was one fake. One of them was like a Trump guy. He was trying to do his, it was an AI Trump. But this other one, Kara. She's already got like blowing up on site. There's nobody. She already knows it's an AI completely. And she's just getting smarter and smarter and smarter and smarter and smarter. And it's about to get very interesting. I mean, the biggest issue we're going to see is a job loss at a massive amount, right? We can't stop that. It's coming like crazy.
100%. Just on this point, Scott, so I want to jump in there. It's like they are becoming more indistinguishable. And we've talked about it previously again, is that we thought automation was coming for the classically blue collar jobs, the construction workers, the manual laborers, all this kind of stuff that we thought of as unskilled and manual and not necessary, right? And everyone would move to the intelligent jobs. But now we're seeing that AI has completely kind of moved that mindset. And really what is going to be replaced is the white collar jobs, the desk-based jobs, the information in, you know, some output, created, right? And they'll be the jobs that disappear. And we're seeing them already disappear. And it's that you say, it's, they're becoming these AI agents indistinguishable from humans. We even see this Google Notebook. It creates a podcast that is unbelievable, like Joe Rogan level style podcast. And we're like, well, what do we do then? What's our place left in the world? And I think there is a place. I think the media creators, I know that that was one of the first things all this Gen AI stuff kind of jumped towards. But I think there's something that people like about fallibility. You know, we, there are 100 meter races, there are sports events. Robots could do that better, but we don't want to see robots running in a 100 meter race. We want to see an underdog story. We want to see people that can make mistakes. I think that might be the niche that humanity sticks towards potentially. Well, I hope anyway.
Yeah, me too. You know, I mean, for me, the thing about, you know, I think we're in a spiritual war at the end of the day between good and evil, in a sense. You can see that dramatically now with everything that's coming out. Some really dark stuff is starting to surface in the on the planet that people are now seeing and had no really idea how deep it was, and it's coming out everywhere. For me, when I look at AI, AI reminds me of the ego. Your ego knows your mind as the as a mind. Your mind knows no right or wrong. Your mind cannot tell what right from wrong. And I can prove that. It's simple. If the mind was capable of knowing truth from falsehood or right from wrong, there'd be no war. Right. Yeah. There's not one person in the world says it's a good idea to blow up those people.
Truth. Yeah.
Right. I mean, so, but what it is that consciousness piece, that internal thing that says, you know, that's not a good idea. When that morals, because morals have been hijacked. That's what I believe. Morals have completely been hijacked now. And if you really look at it, you start looking at it, it's really kind of demonic in a sense, kind of the things that are being pushed out there. You know, again, people try to, I saw this crazy interview with a Satanist priest. Right. And he was talking, he left after like 40 years in this, in the business, right. In his, as one of the top priests in that church. And he was out telling everybody what's going on. And the podcast guy was asking him, so, well, what'd they say when you left and you were going to go out and tell everybody? He says, oh, they all laughed. He says, what do you mean they laughed? He says, yeah. He says, they already know we own your, we're already in your music. We own your music business. We're in your schools. We're in your government, we're everywhere already. He says, but people misunderstand what it is. And they say, well, what is it? He says, what is it? He says, it's an ideology that is all about me. And if it feels good, do it. Morals are secondary. Right? It's okay for me to do this and make sure, but I can step on you. Morals become secondary. And if you start looking at what you're seeing across media, across films, across shows, you can see morals are being eroded in a sense where that's becoming a sort of a secondary thing. So we're seeing all this. And so for me, AI, because it works like the mind, it'll take all this information, but it doesn't really have that consciousness to make it. So for me, there's a really dark side to this AI thing, if whoever's controlling those algorithms, because remember, we got the human condition, right? You can't control that. That there's just people that are just that condition and that being able to program that thinking. So when you look at the behavioral science and how you can basically control people through algorithms and telling them over and through, there was an incredible thing I saw. It was just recently. They did a test where they had 15 people in a row, right? This was back in, you know, the 50s or whatever. And they had 15 people. Well, only one of them didn't know. And they showed the person, the picture at the beginning that was like, they, you know, just, I forget what it was, but the picture was like this, it was, let's say it was blue. It was actually blue. And the person said, oh yeah, that's a red sign. Hand it to the next guy. So that's a red sign, red sign, red sign. They all agreed except the last guy. And at the end, the guy was looking at it. He knew it was blue, but he said it was red. Right? Because the peer pressure of the 15 people making him believe that something was wrong, he wasn't seeing it, made it happen. So I'm worried about the power of, you know, it's one thing us now, we've already had a time of growing up, going to school, going through critical thinking, going through adversity, going through things. But if I wake up with that thing in my hand as a child and they tell me that, you know, this is a car over and over again, it's going to be a car in that person's eyes. So that's the frightening thing is AI. So what I'm hoping is there's going to be AI that's going to be able to check AI. Right. We're going to build trust AI that's going to be able to combat. I have no idea. All I know is it's going to be a very interesting time. And one of the things that really got me was one of my business partners is one of the top CTOs kind of in the world. Big AI guy, has an AI company, number one in the space, 2017. He basically sent a note out to engineers, said, you guys got 18 months. He says, yeah. We now in the lab, oh, wow. We can set the goals with the AI, tell it what to write, and it'll write the code, it will test the code, and it will do the whole thing for us.
Yeah,
I don't need an engineer anymore.
It is scary, right? I think on that ethics point, you are very right. There's lots of like thought experiments that I've seen where they say along the lines of, if you give AI a goal, like a good example is the social media, boost engagement, the outcome is not always what you anticipated. And even though, you know, the input, it's like stuck to the input, the outcome is not something that we could have predicted in advance, but AI has served that purpose. And there's lots of thought experiments around, okay, how far could this go? One of the good ones is, I say, make a paperclip business, and it turns the entire world into a slave kind of order of clip making paper people, right? It's ridiculous. But then what a growing movement I have seen in this space is the idea of ethical AI. Like, because we're now having to reflect that we're no longer the super brains on Earth, and in 10, 20 years time, we might be second best to AI, to the AGIs and all this kind of stuff. It really makes you start to think about, you know, what is ethics? If AI comes about and we've programmed it to do something, what do we want it to be? Like, do we want it to be better than us? And it kind of is the first time I think a lot of us in the Western world have thought, okay, we're no longer top dogs in whatever, you know, means. What do we want to be the standard for ethics going forward for whatever supercomputer we create to go forward, right, and, you know, actually live a good life and mean good for not just humanity, but all living beings? And I think that is hopefully growing fast enough that it will keep the AI in check, maybe, but let's see.
I'm hoping. Yeah, I mean, that's it. We'll see. Yeah. What I will say is, in the end, the Fibonacci sequence, nature will win in the end, no matter what. Yeah. It always turns out that way. Remember, this big giant thing that's moving, we don't need to save the world. The world's fine. It's been spinning. Yeah. It's going to keep on spinning and spinning and spinning. The issue is whether humans are going to be able to make it through this next phase, right? Yeah. Maybe consciousness is just unfolding into a new form of energy, because at the deepest level, at the quantum level, we're just energy. Everything is energy, right?
Exactly.
And so maybe energy is just changing its source and maybe coming more. Maybe the machines are going to become conscious. I mean, who knows, right? I mean, it's interesting. It's a fascinating time.
Exactly. You reminded me, I watched 28 Days Later the other day, and I was reminded of when they quote, you know, if humanity is wiped off the Earth, maybe that is a return to normality for the Earth. So, yeah. That maybe that's where we're heading.
The one thing the planet doesn't need is humans. Right?
Exactly.
It's a little bit type of the deal, right? I mean, when you think about it.
It's a really interesting one. I think maybe we'll have to have you back on one day and talk about all the ethical side and the philosophical side of things. I think there is one I would like to get your take on now, though.
Sure.
You know, while we're talking about Gen AI, and you as a musician, as a creative, even as an entrepreneur, like, you've done so many things that require inspiration and kind of introspective thought about how you create things, right? Whether that's a business or a piece of music or playing a performance. What is your feeling about using AI to create things? Because I'm not much of an artist beyond the podcast, to be honest, but it makes me a little bit unsettled, this idea of starting to replace genuine human creativity with AI generated. Do you have that same sense, or do you think?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, you know, again, we're using it. Like I said, I have a business where everything is AI. And the reason is, you know, to be truthful, I don't like AI, period. I'm just telling you, I'm not an AI fan. I like humanity. I like trees. I like nature. I like all those things. And AI just seems to go against a lot of that from a human point of view. And I think it's making too many people stuck to these machines, right? I mean, if you think about it, we're already embedded in our technology because we carry that phone around everywhere we go, right? It's part of it. There's no question. An example is like with Syntopia, we wrote 2 albums worth of music, and I'm just going to go blow over the top of it in overnight. Wrote it clean. The tracks are kicking ass. They're great, right? The tracks, now I'm going to put some human L over the top of it. It happens. So I can see the creative part of it. I can see using it for specific things, especially when you're trying to write things and do it. But the difference is, the part is that we already have a process of thinking, I'm asking the questions and what we're doing. The issue starts coming down the line is when everything is driven by AI, and that's how you end up learning, right? That's where I think the problem really comes in. It's the early generations that are going to live with this thing. And so, yeah, there's no question. And again, a lot of the thing that I'm finding, here's an example of what I meant. We did a show at NFT LA. I produced two nights at a place called Wisdom. The first night we did it was live music. It was a whole thing. We did an exploration of Pink Floyd with this all-star band thing. It was fantastic. The energy was just intense that night. Nothing changed except we went to a full EDM model. I'm not going to say who it was, whatever. not one thing changed. All the sponsors, all the booths, all the place, everything the same. That music, people were walking around, dum, dum. They were like in a trance, and you could feel the energy was like, it was dark, and it played off of that dark inside thing. And I was so surprised because I could not believe nothing changed. I mean, it was like, it just, the music changed and the people changed, the vibe changed, everything changed. And that's when I just realized, you know, we're in frequency wars right now too, right? Frequencies can change a lot. And we're seeing how they're finding out which frequencies make people react in specific ways. And that's getting built into the music. So I'm not a big fan of what's going on with this stuff. And again, it's thriving on the dark side of energy. So listen, you got to have dark to have light. I mean, I totally understand all that. And that's why it's going to, everything happens the way it's supposed to happen. Otherwise, it wouldn't have happened. It's really simple, right? And so everything is happening the way it should happen. But I think in the end, I think it's starting to flip. People are awakening. I think the reality of the source, communicating, being part of the source, is now becoming more of a thing. And I believe morals have been hijacked.
I think there's many things that we could get into. It's obvious, Scott. Oh, yeah. There's so many things you could talk about. I think are right, though. I think people are waking up to the fact that AI is both quite pervasive in many ways, but also quite subtle. Like the social media influence, we don't really see that AI is under the hood. We don't know that that's happening, but we are very addicted to our phones, and that is almost entirely because of AI. And I think, like you're saying, the kind of the more expansive that becomes, the more it will affect our day-to-day lives. And that is scary, but I think there will, you know, maybe we are a bit safer in the EU, UK potentially because of regulation. And there does need to be regulation. I think, I know regulation is a scary word, but I think it kind of has to come with this stuff because we can't just rely on the morals of the people developing this stuff. Yeah. But Scott, I've learned a lot. We're coming to our closing sections now of the podcast. So I want to ask you a couple of questions. I'm really excited to hear your answers because you've got such an interesting background. So the first one is in just one sentence. So I know this might be a struggle, but what does Web3 mean to you?
Freedom.
Oh, no. You just won. I did not expect that. One, that was good. I like
that.
That's
what it does. Really it sort good. Of represents to me freedom. This is
perfect.
Freedom.
That was the perfect one-word answer. So the second question, and I know you've met and know a lot of famous people, but if you could sit down and have a conversation about Web3 with anyone on the planet from history or even fictional, who would you choose and why?
I think it would be Milton Friedman, economy, because what we're talking about with Web3 changes the entire economic landscape, economics, how it works, and everything, because it really, I'm a hardcore capitalist, because I believe capitalism has been the most incredible thing. It's created more jobs. It's brought more people out of poverty than any other system out there. Now, it has its ups and downs because of the freedom involved in it. Let it, but the human condition is what screws it up. You get greedy people, and people do things, but this changes the whole landscape of economics. And I would love to have a conversation with him about that, because I'm a fan of the way he thinks about how economies work. And we're going into a new time frame with Web3 that changes how economies work. And it actually puts the power in the hands of the currency, in the hands of the people. And so I would love to have that conversation with him.
I like that. That's a really good one. So what's the quote about capitalism? It may not be a perfect system, but it's still the best one there is.
Best one, man, period. Because the other ones, if you think about what happens is when you think about a socialist system, it destroys creativity. It destroys innovation because it puts the people at the top. And it's like, okay, it sounds good. It sounds fantastic, utopia. But the problem is now you're putting the power in the hands of a handful of people to make the decisions for all of us. I'd rather have it free market. I'm a free market capitalist. I believe in free markets because at the end of the day, they will eat themselves. They will grow. It will do all of these things. And the idea of, you know, putting caps on the economy and on pricing is insane because of what you go look. It just, I tell everybody, go find this video on YouTube. It's how a pencil is made. And you will be blown away that it takes tens of thousands of people to make one pencil.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Okay. I've seen that.
Because the trees got to get cut. And then that's the miner. Then they take the tree and it goes to the other factory where they have to mill it down. And then it goes to another factory where they cut it into boards. And then it goes to somebody else. And then the lead has to go through all the same things. And when you try to put a price cap on at the top, you go, well, what happens if lead went up 400%? You're killing my business because I got to buy it at 400 down here and I can't raise my price. Bad idea. Completely destroys free markets, destroys businesses, destroys everything. So when I hear politicians talking about that one, it's like, oh, that's a really, really bad idea. And it's been proven over and over again, yet they want to do this. I don't get it. It's crazy. Yeah.
Well, it's a great answer. And I love that the quote you just mentioned as well, Alec, the, you know, it's the best one we've got. I've heard that one in the context of democracy, not capitalism, but I think it applies equally well to both. So I think that's an interesting observation. And I think on Milton Friedman is a really good one, I think, Scott. I don't think we've had that on the show before, but I know lots of people in the Bitcoin and crypto space, they kind of talk a lot about his ideas and how they apply to Bitcoin maybe. So I think, yeah, that would be a great choice. I'd like to be at that dinner party for sure. And
I would just love to hear how he thinks about this, how we can build these circular tokens that feed tokens and do all this stuff and create a different business model around smaller groups of people, around culture, around hives, right? It's great. It's cool. I'm so excited about this stuff because it is really innovative. And that's why I'm so excited about our Shiba Wings tote project, because I think we can be a real exemplar and get us out of the, you know, there's so many scams in the meme token world and people just trying to get rich quick. Ours is really a business building, and really, how do we use tokens to really drive a real world business, and how does the real world business really feed a token in the business? So very exciting times to innovate, and I'm excited that you know, I think we're about to see this massive bull run. I don't know if you've been watching Bitcoin today. It's moving up. It's already creeping, waiting for this election to go, because if it goes the way it looks like it's gonna go, this thing's gonna
absolutely Scott, I'm sure you won't be surprised that I can say that your passion is clear and it's infectious. So yeah, we know you're a busy man. We'll let you get back some of your day and maybe have some time to watch this crazy election unfold. And listen, Scott, it's been such a great pleasure to have you on. Thank you so much for sharing your time.
Thanks so much for having me. It's nice to have a good free thinking conversation.
It's a big echo. And to those listening, wherever you may be, join us next time to untangle a little more Web3.
Thanks for tuning in to another episode of Untangling Web3.
Don't forget to send us your thoughts, questions, and comments on social media. And be sure to follow us on your favorite podcast provider to catch the next episode. See you next time to untangle a little bit more of Web3.
The views we express here are our own and do not reflect the views of our employers.